From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Son was in Las Vegas with a lot of his friends and he came home. He didn't come home last night, and I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control.
The city of Thousand Oaks is mourning after a Marine Corps veteran opened fire in a Southern California country music bar, killing 12 people. One of the murder victims had survived last year's Las Vegas massacre at a country music concert, the worst mass shooting in modern American history. We speak with Navy veteran Sarah Dacius with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. She asks why, after police were called to his house months ago, it didn't trigger red flag laws. Why did he still have his gun? Then to Florida, where days after the midterm elections, the state's races for Senate and governor appear to be headed to a recount.
Whether it's an absentee vote, whether you voted on Election Day, whether it is a provisional ballot, we want every vote counted. We didn't go across this state talking to folks in red county and blue counties and purple counties not to have them have their say.
Could Andrew Gillum still become governor of Florida? We speak with Andrea Christina Mercado of the new Florida majority, then to Detroit, where Rashida Tlaib has made history as one of the nation's two first Muslim congresswomen.
The fact that now two Muslim American women are going to be able to walk into the House floor of Congress, what an incredible moment in our country. Celebrate it.
And we speak with peace activist Kathy Kelly, who protested on the steps of the Saudi consulate in New York City yesterday.
We want an immediate end to all of the warring parties fighting and bombing in Yemen. We want an immediate opening of every roadway, of every port, so that humanitarian goods can be distributed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The city of Thousand Oaks, California, remains in mourning after a former Marine opened fire at a country music bar Wednesday night, killing 12 people, mostly students. It was the deadliest mass shooting in the United States since the Parkland, Florida school shooting in February. Police have identified the gunman as 28-year-old Ian David Long, a Marine veteran who deployed to Afghanistan and had a history of mental health issues, including possible PTSD. Police said Long set off smoke grenades inside the bar before opening fire using a Glock 45 caliber handgun equipped with an extended ammunition magazine. Long also died inside the bar. He reportedly frequented the Borderline Bar and Grill before the shooting and had multiple interactions with local authorities. Earlier this year, he was evaluated by mental health professionals after police responded to a disturbance at his home he shared with his mother, but he was cleared by the specialists. On Thursday, Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean discussed Long's previous encounters with law enforcement.
We've had several contacts with Mr. Long over the years, minor events such as a traffic collision. He was a victim of a battery at a local bar in 2015. In April of this year, deputies were called to his house for a subject disturbing. They went to the house. They talked to him. He was somewhat irate, acting a little irrationally. They called out our crisis intervention team, our mental health specialist, who met with him, talked to him, and cleared him, didn't feel that he was qualified to be taken under 5150, and he was left at that scene last April.
We'll have more on the shooting after headlines. In other news from California, massive wildfires have scorched parts of both Northern and Southern California. The town of Paradise, about 90 miles north of Sacramento, has been devastated after a fast-spreading fire forced tens of thousands to evacuate and burned over 1,000 buildings and homes to the ground. The fire reportedly killed multiple people in Paradise. Meanwhile, in Ventura County, the raging Hill Fire, not far from Wednesday night's mass shooting, threatens to burn up to 30,000 acres as firefighters continue to battle the flames. A federal judge in Montana has temporarily halted the construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The Keystone XL would carry oil from Canada's tar sands region in Alberta to refineries as far away as the Gulf of Mexico. The court's decision will require the Trump administration to more thoroughly review the potential negative impacts of the pipeline and the surrounding environment, as well as its effects on climate change. President Obama halted the construction of the pipeline in 2015 following mass public protests, but Trump reversed the order shortly after he became president. Environmental and indigenous groups hailed the decision Thursday. Sierra Club attorney Doug Hayes said in a statement, "The Trump administration tried to force this dirty pipeline project on the American people, but they can't ignore the threats it would pose to our clean water, our climate, and our communities," he wrote. It's unclear whether the Trump administration will appeal the decision. For a complete coverage of the Keystone XL pipeline, go to our website at democracynow.org. House Democrats called for an emergency hearing Thursday following President Trump's ouster of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Democrats urged the passing of a bill that would protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller as he continues his probe into potential Russian collusion with the Trump campaign in the 2016 election. Democrats also formally requested the preservation of all documents related to Jeff Sessions' forced resignation, writing, "We remind you that concealing, removing, or destroying such documents may constitute a crime," unquote. In the Senate, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona and Democrat Chris Coons of Delaware said they will push for a floor vote on a bipartisan bill to protect Mueller's probe. Meanwhile, a New York Times op-ed published Thursday claims Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker as new acting attorney general is unconstitutional. The op-ed column was written by Neil Katyal, the former acting Solicitor General under President Obama, and George Conway, the high-profile litigator and husband of White House counselor Kellyanne Conway. They write, quote, "Constitutionally, Matthew Whitaker is a nobody. His job as Mr. Sessions' chief of staff did not require Senate confirmation. For the president to install Mr. Whitaker as our chief law enforcement officer is to betray the entire structure of our charter document," they wrote. This comes as Trump is reportedly considering former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, or Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta for attorney general. Meanwhile, Thursday night, demonstrations were held in over 1,000 cities and towns calling for the protection of the Mueller probe. This is protester Christina De La Riva in New York.
I don't think anyone here is defending Jeff Sessions. I think what we're defending is integrity of the Justice Department. I think we're defending the integrity of institutions. I think the president has attacked our important institutions, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and I think that everyone should be held to account. Everyone is, you know, accountable, and including the president.
The Trump administration's announced new immigration rules to deny asylum to anyone who enters the country outside of a port of entry. The American Civil Liberties Union called the move illegal, saying, quote, U.S. law specifically allows individuals to apply for asylum whether or not they are at a port of entry. It's illegal to circumvent that by agency or presidential decree, they wrote. Trump, who turned the Central American caravans traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border into a major campaign issue in the lead-up to the midterm elections, is expected to announce which countries will be affected by the rules today. Trump, invoking national security concerns, plans to use the same legal provision the White House used to push the travel ban last year. This comes as new court filings show there are still 171 children separated from their families in U.S. custody, more than 4 months after a judge ordered the Trump administration to reunite all families that were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border. In more immigration news, a California appeals court ruled Thursday the Trump administration cannot shut down the DACA program, upholding a federal judge's ruling earlier this year. DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, affects the immigration status of some 700,000 formerly undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as children. Trump announced plans to do away with the program last year and was immediately challenged by lawsuits from a number of states and other groups. The ruling sets the case up for a possible Supreme Court hearing in 2019. In election news, several key races remain too close to call 3 days after the midterm elections. In Arizona's Senate race, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema has taken a slight lead over Republican opponent Martha McSally. Hundreds of thousands of ballots remain to be counted, mostly in Maricopa County, the state's largest county. In Florida, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum said he's prepared for a possible recount as his margin with Republican opponent Ron DeSantis has narrowed to less than half a percentage point. Gillum conceded to DeSantis on election night after the race was called for his opponent, but the margin has since tightened. A recount is automatically triggered in Florida if the winning candidate's margin is less than half a percentage point. Incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and Republican Governor Rick Scott will likely head to a recount in the Senate race, with Scott leading by just 0.2%. In Georgia, the Republican candidate for governor, Brian Kemp, has resigned as Secretary of State. The closely watched race for governor has yet to be called, though Kemp has declared victory. His opponent, Democrat Stacey Abrams, has vowed to stay in the race until every vote is counted. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders is coming under fire for sharing an apparently doctored video of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta's interaction with a White House intern at Wednesday's news conference with the president. The video was originally shared by an account linked to InfoWars, a far-right conspiracy website, and appears to speed up the moment of contact between Acosta and an intern while she tried to take the mic away, making it seem like he was aggressively pushing down her arm. The Washington Post published a side-by-side Thursday showing the original footage and the apparently edited video. The White House banned Jim Acosta on Wednesday, ostensibly because of the interaction, hours after he clashed with President Trump at the news conference, demanding answers on the caravan. Planned talks between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and North Korean officials were postponed Thursday. Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley later said it was because the North Koreans weren't ready, though recent reports suggest North Korea is unhappy with the lack of concessions from the U.S. in the ongoing talks over denuclearization, namely on the issue of easing sanctions. Trump has said he plans to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un early next year to continue talks on a denuclearization agreement. In Gaza, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian man at the separation barrier with Israel Thursday. 220 Gazans have been killed since the Great March of Return demonstrations began over 7 months ago, this according to Gazan officials. The Trump administration has announced new sanctions over Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. This comes as both Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin have said they might hold talks in France next week as they attend Armistice Day celebrations in Paris. Google's overhauling its policies for dealing with claims of sexual misconduct after tens of thousands of workers worldwide staged a mass walkout last week. Google said Thursday it'll end its practice of forced arbitration, which usually happens in private settings and often forces employees to agree to confidentiality clauses. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was hospitalized after a fall Wednesday evening resulted in three fractured ribs. The health of the liberal 85-year-old justice, the oldest sitting justice on the Supreme Court, has come under increased scrutiny in recent years. She previously fractured two ribs in 2012 and is a double cancer survivor. Once news of her fall became public, many took to social media to offer their support. Actress Alyssa Milano wrote, "Ruth Bader Ginsburg can have my ribs and my kidneys and a lung and anything else she needs. She can even have my husband on Thursdays." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The city of Thousand Oaks, California, is mourning after a former Marine opened fire at a country music bar Wednesday night, killing 12 people, mostly students. It was the deadliest mass shooting in the United States since the Parkland, Florida school shooting in February, when 17 people were killed. Police have identified the gunman as 28-year-old Ian David Long, a Marine veteran who had deployed to Afghanistan and had a history of mental health issues, including possible PTSD. Police said Long set off smoke grenades inside the bar before opening fire using a Glock 45 caliber handgun equipped with an extended ammunition magazine. Long then turned the gun on himself, they say. Long reportedly frequented the Borderline Bar and Grill before the shooting and had multiple interactions with local authorities. Earlier this year, he was evaluated by mental health professionals after police responded to a disturbance at his home where he lived with his mother. But he was cleared by the specialists. CNN reports a neighbor said Long's mother lived in fear of what her son might do. The dead include 27-year-old Telemachus Orfanos, who survived the deadly Las Vegas massacre at a country music festival last year, only to be gunned down Wednesday night. This is his mother, Susan Schmidt Orfanos.
My son was in Las Vegas with a lot of his friends, and he came home. He didn't come home last night, and I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control.
Many of the victims are students. The youngest named victim is 18-year-old Elena Housley, a freshman at Pepperdine University. Ron Helas from the Ventura County Sheriff's Office, who responded to the shooting, was also killed in the attack. He'd been on the force for about three decades. CNN reports around the time of the shooting, Long posted to Facebook, writing, "I hope people call me insane. Wouldn't that just be a big ball of irony? Yeah, I'm insane. But the only thing you people do after these shootings is hopes and prayers, or keep you in my thoughts every time, and wonder why these keep happening," the gunman allegedly wrote on Facebook. Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by our guest, Sarah Dacius. She's a Navy veteran and volunteer with the D.C. chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, founding member of the Everytown Veterans Advisory Council. Sarah, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you please respond to what took place? One of the worst mass shootings. It is horrifying to say. The one that was even worse was just months ago. That was Parkland, the killing of the high school. And, of course, the horrific shooting that took place in Las Vegas at a country music festival, where one of the survivors of that were gunned down Wednesday night at the country music bar.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Amy. We're Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is an advocacy organization that pushes legislators to pass common sense gun legislation. And what happened in California and what happens in the United States over and over and over again just shows how much we need to have common sense gun legislation passed. What happened on Tuesday with the midterms is proof that the American people feel the same way. We had gun sense champion after gun sense champion elected into Congress and will be putting up their hand to in January to swear to help and protect the American people. And one of the ways to do that is with common sense gun legislation.
So talk about what you understand happened on Wednesday night. You're a Navy vet. Apparently, Ian Long, the gunman who may have taken his own life after killing 12 people, was a Marine veteran. Talk about your response to this, what happened, the fact that the police had been called to his house where he lives with his mother, that his mother was afraid, mental health professionals were called in, yet he still kept his gun.
Yes, that is. We understand that there's still more information to be brought out. But what we feel very strongly about is that red flag laws help to prevent these types of mass shootings and suicides. You know, 67% of gun deaths that occur in the United States are self-inflicted.
Explain what red flag laws are.
Absolutely. So red flag laws is another way to put it is extreme risk protective order. And what that does is it allows a loved one or a law enforcement or anybody, in fact, who thinks that somebody will wound themselves, do harm to themselves or others, they can have the gun temporarily taken away. California actually was the first state to pass the red flag laws in 2014 after they also had another mass shooting at that time with somebody who, if the gun had been taken away, probably would not have done this mass shooting. So if we find more information about what has happened and why this young man did not have his gun taken away, this is the type of legislation that helps with mass shootings.
You know, a number of people have commented that the flipping of the House to Democratic, that a part of that can be attributed to the Parkland kids. The killing earlier this year on Valentine's Day of 17 people in Parkland, Florida. And their almost immediate reaction, the survivors demanding gun laws in the country, in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida. Many state laws have changed. Then they traveled the country in a caravan with many other young people from all over the country. Can you talk about what it means to have flipped the House, but in fact, ultimately, on any legislation, it's President Trump, an NRA, a major supporter of the NRA, would have to sign off on.
Absolutely. And we can never predict, no one can predict what President Trump is going to do. But what I will say is that by flipping the House, and specifically flipping the House with numerous gun sense champions, we are going to see these champions fight for gun sense legislation in the House. We already have some gun sense legislation champions also in the Senate. Senator Chris Murphy has been an incredible leader on this front. And with them influencing, they will be able to continue to change the culture in America and continue to work on these issues. What I will say is flipping the House is one thing. It absolutely was crucial. And the reason that the House was able to flip was, as you implied, the Parkland students and this tide that has turned in our country since February. The tide had already been starting to turn before February. We were seeing state legislative bodies pass gun sense legislation in the last 3 or 4 years. Nothing like we've seen this year, but that it has happened in the last 3 or 4 years. And the tide just kept building and building and building. When Parkland happened, the energy and the enthusiasm and the anger of these Parkland students and other students across the country enabled contributed to ensuring that these midterms happened the way they did on the House side. What I really want to talk about also in terms of that is Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America and many other gun violence prevention organizations work on a cultural shift. It is one thing to go to the ballot, to canvas, to phone bank, to get people to the ballot. But to get people to the ballot, the cultural change has to happen. The beliefs and values of Americans has to change, and it's changing. It is changing. We want to have gun sense legislation because we want our communities to be safe. And I also want to bring up the point, when you say this about the Parkland students, let us not forget that there are urban students, students who live in urban environments, who have experienced gun violence constantly, who had been protesting even before the Parkland students protested, who were using their First Amendment right to protest, to engage with their members of Congress, to engage with their legislators on the city level or on the state level. And they were turning the tide as well. This tide has been turning for a long time.
Someone pointed out that this was the 304th mass shooting in the U.S. this year, almost one per day. Finally, I want to go to the military background of the shooter. You're a Navy veteran. He was a Marine. He served apparently in Helmand Province in 2010 at the height of the surge, was a gunner. He used a Glock with an extended magazine. And, you know, there's not a lot known at this point. May have been suffering from PTSD. But can you talk about this military connection, and then also, you know, the gun he used and the magazine, why he had that, and was this magazine illegal, at least?
Right. My understanding is that the magazine was illegal in California state law, so it's not clear to us how he was able to obtain that that magazine. What I can tell you is that states, even though California has some of the strictest gun laws in the country, states around California do not. And in terms of his military experience, yes, I am a Navy vet, and my role as a Navy vet and my role while I was in the military was when we're around weapons, we are safe around weapons. And I'm sure this young man was taught in his Marine Corps time how to be 100% safe with his weapon, how to lock it up, how to keep his ammunition separated from his weapon. when it comes to the PTSD element, we have vets who have suffered from PTSD. We have the numbers are incredibly heart-wrenching how many vets die a day from self-inflicting wounds with a gun because they have access to guns.
We're talking something like 17 vets a day kill themselves?
I've heard numbers that are above 20 vets a day. And it's part of the reason that I got involved with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, that as a vet, to know that my fellow vets are in situations where they are so devastated by what happened to them while they were serving in the military, or maybe even not while they were in the military, but have these mental challenges, are so stressed that they feel that they want to take their own lives. But also, not to steer away from the veteran aspect of it or the military aspect of it, we have this issue with Americans all over the country, whether they served or not. We have this issue with students and youth who live in urban environments where gun violence is the reality of every single day. So this is an issue that we have to address across the country. This is an issue where if we are going to lower gun violence, whether it is with mass shootings or with everyday violence that happens, whether it's suicide, like I said, 67% of Americans die because of suicide with a gun. We need to be working on the mental health aspects of this, too, and how we prevent violence through community-based approaches.
Sarah,
the end of the day.
Last 10 seconds.
Yes.
You're...
At the end of the day, we need to prevent access to guns, because that is the prevalent issue, the ubiquitous issue, is that guns are so accessible.
Sarah Dacius, I want to thank you for being with us, volunteer with D.C. Chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, founding member of Everytown Veterans Advisory Council and Navy veteran. This is Democracy Now! Back in 30 seconds with what's happening with the races in Florida.
All the money in your hands, all the possessions anyone can ever have, but it's our worth, it's treasure, true worth, is only better, not about what you got, but what you got.
Stand Up for Something, Andrew Day at the March for Our Lives with the Baltimore Choir in Washington, D.C. last March. 800,000 people marched against gun violence. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to Florida, we're days after the midterm elections. The state's races for Senate and governor appear to be heading for recounts. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum said he's prepared for a possible recount as his margin with Republican opponent Ron DeSantis narrowed to less than half a percentage point Thursday. Gillum conceded to DeSantis election night after the race was called for his opponent, but the margin has since tightened. A recount is triggered in Florida if the winning candidate's margin is less than half a percentage point. Incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson and Republican Governor Rick Scott will likely also head to a recount in the Senate race, with Scott leading by less than a quarter of a percentage point as of Thursday. That's 0.2%. On Thursday evening, Republican Florida Governor Rick Scott sued the Democratic election supervisors of Broward and Palm Beach counties. He accused them of, quote, unethical liberals of trying to steal the election.
We've all seen the incompetence and irregularities in vote tabulations in Broward and Palm Beach for years. Well, here we go again. I will not sit idly by while unethical liberals try to steal this election from the great people of Florida. Senator Nelson hired one of Hillary Clinton's lawyers from D.C., and the first thing he did was tell reporters that he's here to win the election. He did not say that he wants a full and fair election or even an accurate vote count.
These will be the first statewide recounts since Bush v. Gore in 2000. For more, we go to Fort Lauderdale, where we're joined by Andrea Christina Mercado, executive director of the New Florida Majority. Welcome to Democracy Now! Please explain to the country what's happening in your state, Andrea.
I'm here in the heart of Broward County, where we are still waiting for every vote to be counted. This was a, we had a race in the governor's race that was historic and significant. Andrew Gillum had an upset victory in the primary. We endorsed him and ran one of the largest field programs because we know that candidates that run on transformative platforms can energize a new electorate and bring out people who don't usually come to the polls. And we saw historic turnout. 250,000 people who didn't vote in 2016 voted in this election. And yet on election night, as is so often the case in Florida, it was razor thin margins and it was pointing towards a DeSantis victory. And yet, every vote remains to be counted here in Broward County. Many of our votes have not yet been tabulated. And Andrew Gillum is now within what is triggered for an automatic machine recount. And Senator Nielsen is headed for a manual recount, a recount that happens by hand when a race is won or lost by less than a quarter of a percentage point. This is, 15,000 votes in a state with over 20 million people. So there's a lot of people on the edge of their seats that are really hoping that actually the forces for unity and a vision for a Florida where all of us belong will prevail in this election. In some of these key races.
Florida's chief legal officer, the Secretary of State, Ken Dentzner, told county election supervisors to plan for three statewide recounts.
That's correct. So we have Andrew Gillum and DeSantis, the governor's race, is heading to a machine recount. Senator Nielsen and Rick Scott is headed to a manual recount. And Nikki Fried, the agriculture commissioner, is now up 3,000 votes as the votes in Broward County continue to be tabulated.
So can you explain, Andrea, what's going on in Broward? I mean, we all, those who are born by 2000 with Bush v. Gore, the whole issue of Chads and everything else. Explain what's happened on that ballot and how difficult it was to read and why so many people who filled out their choice for governor actually didn't vote in the Senate race.
Yeah. I mean, it's very frustrating for all of us here in Broward County. I was in that voting booth with my two daughters and really had to search for where I was going to vote for U.S. Senate. It was on the left-hand side and below many of the other significant statewide races. And so it was a little bit hidden and obscured. The design of the ballot was flawed. And we believe that that's resulted in, tens of thousands of people not voting in the race for U.S. Senate while they voted for many other statewide races. It's very concerning.
What happened in Little Miami, Little Haiti in Miami, the early voting site different than the voting site on the day of the midterms?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, we've seen for years the ways that the vote is suppressed. Some of it is done by laws, like the law that we had on the books where people with a criminal record after they had done their time were not allowed to participate in our democracy. Over 1.4 million Floridians. We just overturned that on Election Day, which is incredibly significant. There are all kinds of other laws, voter ID laws. I spoke to an 86-year-old woman yesterday who had to fill out a provisional ballot because her driver's license was expired. Imagine that. She's 86. She doesn't drive anymore. And in addition to that, there are attempts to confuse voters. So in Little Haiti, there was one very prominent site in the Haitian community that was used as an early voting site. And on Election Day, hundreds of seniors were lined up there to cast a historic vote for Andrew Gillum. And yet that location was not actually a voting place on Election Day. And people were told that they had to go elsewhere. And so we were scrambling to find out how do we get, seniors and people with limited mobility to the correct voting place. And I think we're still investigating other ways that the vote may have been suppressed. And I wouldn't be surprised if, stories have been emerging, and I wouldn't be more surprised if more stories continue to emerge over the next few days.
So very finally, the issue of Amendment 4, this historic amendment that passed overwhelmingly, that means 1.4 million Floridians will now be allowed to vote, one of the largest enfranchisement actions in history. Young people being able to vote back in the 70s, going from 21 to 18, and back to women being able to vote in 1920. 1.4 million Floridians could now vote in 2020, who had felonies on their record, were barred from voting. Now they will be able to. What difference would that make today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, essentially, Andrew Gillum got within half a percentage point while he was missing 18% of the black vote in the state. We all know that criminalization disproportionately impacts African Americans and communities of color. And there's now 1.4 million Floridians who have been disenfranchised, largely people of color, who will be able to vote in the next election. So I think this has forever changed the political calculus in Florida. And, we truly believe that the forces for social justice and economic justice and racial equity, it's just a matter of time before we prevail, and that we will overcome all the odds and voter suppression and every other dirty trick in the book and soon secure victory and elect politicians that we believe will really fight for our communities.
If Andrew Gillum were to win the governorship, he'd be the first black governor of Florida. He seemed as surprised as many other people, Andrea.
At the narrowing, at the shrinking margins?
Yes, or, that there could be a recount.
I mean, I think
triggered.
It's been a... Absolutely. I mean, I think Tuesday night was a hard night. It was a bitter pill to swallow. But I think for us, we know that, our movements will never concede to hate. We will never concede to homophobia. We will never concede to bigotry. And we will be here insisting that every vote is counted. There were hundreds of volunteers across the state yesterday, making sure that people who had cast provisional ballots had done what they needed to do to make sure that their voice was heard. And we'll continue to see everyone taking to the streets on November 20th. We'll have a statewide day of action for us to stand up for a Florida for all of us.
Andrea Christina Mercado, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the New Florida Majority. When we come back, one of the many firsts in this midterm election, one of two Muslim women Congress member elects. We'll be joined by Rashida Tlaib from Detroit. Stay with us.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's there?
Talking about revolution by Tracy Chapman. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday evening, Palestinian-American Rashida Tlaib in Michigan and Somali-American Ilhan Omar in Minnesota became the first Muslim women elected to Congress. Rashida Tlaib is a democratic socialist who supports the Palestinian right of return and a one-state solution. She also supports Medicare for All, a $15 minimum wage, and abolishing ICE. The child of immigrants, Tlaib has spoken out against the Trump administration's travel bans. This is Rashida Tlaib celebrating her historic victory.
Rashida! Rashida! Rashida!
I want you to know my mom, who's from a small village in the West Bank, they're literally glued. It's like 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. And now it's more than that. But they're glued to the TV. My grandmother, my aunts, my uncles in Palestine are sitting by and watching their granddaughters. single day being who I am as a proud Palestinian American and woman.
Yes!
In 2016, Rashida Tlaib made news when she confronted then-candidate Donald Trump at the Detroit Economic Club. She got up and shouted, "Have you ever read the U.S. Constitution?" She was taken out by security. For more, we go to Madison Heights, Michigan, where we're joined by Rashida Tlaib, the Democratic Congresswoman-elect, Michigan's 13th congressional district. Rashida Tlaib, welcome to Democracy Now! And congratulations. How do you feel? You have made history.
It's overwhelming, but it's happy chaos is what I describe it as. And I'm just ready to get to work. I just feel like there's so much at stake right now and very limited time for us to be able to change people's lives. And I'm just ready to get things going and to, you know, provide neighborhood service centers throughout my district for the residents of the 13th. As you probably know, Amy, I have been campaigning for 9 months, and this is the third poorest congressional district in the country, and the need is so great. And we haven't had representation for almost a year now, with Congressman Conyers retiring earlier this year.
So talk about your platform and what you hope to push through when you become a Congress member.
Well, Justice for All Civil Rights Act is my first proposal that I've put forward. This is, months of me listening to a lot of the residents within the 13th congressional district. And, you know, one number one issue people might not even realize here in Michigan, and especially in my district, is that we have the highest car insurance rates in the country. My zip code 48227, literally, it's the average of like $5,000. Pushing people more into poverty, taking away access to jobs in many ways because they don't have transportation and we don't have mass transit here in the Metro Detroit area. And so what came about by looking at this is the fact that Civil Rights Act of 64, a historic act that very much intended this kind of discriminatory practice, this car insurance redlining practice, to be a civil rights violation. Well, what happened, and many people know this, over the last 50 years after passing the 64 Act, our courts got increasingly more conservative. They started watering it down. And now, for us to go up against corporations and others, we have to show this high threshold of intent, intentional discrimination. Well, the Justice for All Civil Rights Act that I'm going to introduce says, no, if we can show that the impact of that policy and that process that they're using is discriminatory in practice, then that should be enough for us to say the rights of civil rights of folks within my district and around the country is being violated. Less than half of my families in the 13th congressional district don't own their own homes. The practices that by banks currently within even just in communities of color have now increasingly become more discriminatory. More and more of my residents don't have access to lending, don't have access to economic opportunities, equal access. And so the Justice for All Civil Rights Act is transformative in that way, in that we can start looking at these processes and these structures, really these very, very much strong structures and barriers within these kinds of corporations and the practices by many of their CEOs as violations of people's civil rights. And that alone will open up those doors and push back against things that I feel like are very much un-American.
Mm. On the issue of foreign policy, this certainly isn't foreign policy because your mother was standing right next to you as you were giving your victory speech Tuesday night. Your mother wears a hijab. Your family is Palestinian. You have expressed firmly your support for a one-state solution. Can you talk about how you will try to make this happen in the U.S. Congress?
Look, all of it has to happen organically. I mean, people on the ground need to want it. All I know is from my own experiences is that, you know, from dehumanizing, I don't care if it's Israelis or Palestinians, the dehumanization of people, of human beings that really just want to live with human dignity, want equality, want access to the same economic opportunities that even American families want. This is what's lacking in the conversations when we talk about a lot about what's going on in Palestine and what's going on in some of the occupied territories and what's going on even among Israelis. Majority of them, you know, thinking that maybe we can have a two-state solution. Maybe that's the direction that many of them want. And if that's what they want, then that's their
right to self-determine and to gain that. What I can tell you is what I know from my own experience in the United States, looking at real American history, and that separate but equal doesn't work. It didn't. We tried it. But again, this is what is happening here in America, and they're looking at our own history, right? I mean, that's what I understood is, saying, well, you can only live here. You can only work here. These are the hospitals that you should go to. I keep thinking of my grandmother. Siti Muftiya is, in her age. She's probably in her late 80s now. She doesn't know what year she was born. And when I talk to her, she doesn't think Israeli past. She thinks this is where I live. This is where I want to be able to go to the hospital, get care that I want, to be able to farm my own land without getting harassed. Right next to her home is a checkpoint. She never could have imagined having to be able to be checked before she could leave her home. And those are the things that I'll be able to do is try to uplift her and many of the Palestinians that very much feel dehumanized. I can try to share those stories that very much relate to the stories I heard from my African-American teachers who taught me about African-American history and why, separate but equal didn't work and why, I really strongly believe that if we stop, segregating, that we start integrating the schools there, if we start really talking to each other, not relying on, looking at Trump's America, which is so much like Netanyahu's Israel, that if we stop talking about these divisive, hateful kind of messages that are coming through to so many people, and it is so much not what's happening on the ground. I truly believe Israelis want the same thing. They want peaceful solution, and that may result in them trying to look at my grandmother and saying, yes, you deserve equal rights just as much as I do.
Will you try to impeach President Trump?
Yes, I truly believe that he's obstructing justice. It is very clear that something is wrong within our own government. You can like the man, but I could tell you, I know you like the rule of law about more. And in America, there is laws that we all follow, that we all should equally be held accountable to. And I can tell you very strongly that this is not political for me. I mean, he could be a Democratic president, and I would still say the same thing. Obstruction of justice. And as an attorney myself, I can tell you, when we start kind of turning our heads and letting a little bit of things slip by, like what we've seen the last few days, we are jeopardizing our own democracy. We are jeopardizing that accountability and that balance of government that's there that is so critical for us to live in a free country. We cannot allow him to taint this process that's there for a reason. And I'm very much willing to start investigating and leaning towards that if he has anything to do with obstruction justice, and it pretty much sounds like he is trying to sway this investigation and trying to make sure that he protects himself instead of protecting our own country.
Will you support Nancy Pelosi, who's just announced she will go for the House speakership?
I'm really so much focused on helping the other women of color. I mean, I don't know if you know, it's not just me and Ilhan Omar, but some of the youngest members of Congress, beautiful colors of women are coming into the United States Congress, from Ayanna to Jahana to Deb Haaland to the beautiful Charisse Davids. We have such an incredible class that is coming, and I'm so focused on really trying to uplift them, to lean on each other, to making sure that we are able to serve the families and the residents that believed in us back home very effectively. And so we want to focus really on that and focus on making sure that we have a seat at the table, that we can truly be heard, not just displayed as like, oh, look, our caucus is now diverse. Great. Now put us at a table where we can actually have a voice, where we can actually feel like we can make a difference in a lot of the issues that we feel is critically important for our families back home.
You're a member of Democratic Socialists America. Explain what democratic socialism is.
For me, right now in Detroit, this is what it means. I have fought so heavily against corporate tax breaks, especially because I've seen our schools in Detroit close down. I mean, close to 60 schools have already closed down in the city of Detroit while we're channeling public money. You know, these are our own taxes into a hockey stadium. The Red Wings Hockey Stadium downtown Detroit, 60% of the funds that went towards that hockey stadium that could have gone to schools. We're talking about $400 million away from schools into an adult playground, a for-profit industry. That, to me, is completely unethical, immoral. And for me, it means living in a just, fair, equitable society. And that is not fair when you have billionaires in the corporate welfare line, when our children are still hungry, when our schools are still underfunded, where I can't even get our fire hydrants in some of our neighborhoods fixed, or I can't even understand right now the lack of resources that we have to deal with the increasing concentration of poverty in many of the neighborhoods. It's wrong, and truly to me against what I believe is the role of government, which is it should be about people, not corporations.
I wanted to turn now to Yemen, but also bring in a second guest, a woman who's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, I don't know how many times, Kathy Kelly. But the crisis in Yemen, where the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition has drastically escalated its assault on the Yemeni port of Hodeidah. The Guardian reports there have been at least 200 airstrikes in the past week, killing at least 150 people. One Saudi airstrike destroyed a home in Hodeidah, killing a father and his five children. The increase attacks come as calls grow for a ceasefire to the three-year war, which has devastated Yemen. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis have both called for a ceasefire in Yemen. On Thursday, a group of Yemeni and international organizations called for an immediate ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, warning 14 million people are now on the brink of famine. The United Nations calls this the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world. In addition to Rashida Tlaib, we want to get your response to this. We're joined by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end military and economic warfare. You helped organize a protest outside the Saudi consulate in New York yesterday, and you're protesting as well today, Kathy. What are you calling for?
Well, we certainly want to see an immediate end to the fighting and an immediate lifting of any of the blockades of ports or of roadways. And we want to see the children focused on as the most important issue right now, not political maneuvering in order before a ceasefire to try and make the biggest grabs that any group can. As you say, it's a very dire situation. And the United Nations people who've sounded the alarm have said that a complete collapse could happen, leading to the famine that could cause starvation of 14 million people.
So you were outside the Saudi consulate. What about the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Well, two of our people were arrested and held briefly outside of the U.S. mission to the U.N. You know, what we want to say to people inside those offices who say, well, we're just trying to go to our jobs, is that if there was human trafficking or if there was some kind of narco trafficking going on in the office next door to you inside that building, wouldn't you feel like you had a responsibility to do something? Well, we have a responsibility to end the U.S. complicity in this hideous atrocity that keeps unfolding every day, and certainly to stand up to the Saudis. And I think people who work within those offices join in that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. The murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, on October 2nd by Saudi officials. The dismemberment and murder. Still, it's not clear where his body is. Called some attention to what's happening in Yemen because it called attention to the murderous policy of the Saudi regime. Do you feel there's some movement in Congress right now?
I think there is some movement. I think that all would be willing to acknowledge that it's too little and for many, many people, too late. The dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi was so ghastly, and it made people realize that the Saudis would go to great lengths to cover up, to obfuscate, to delay any kind of action. But certainly the dismemberment of children who've been hit by aerial attacks is just as ghastly. The strangulation of Jamal Khashoggi was also horrible, but essentially when
and
children...
And called attention to what's happening in Yemen.
And when children die from starvation, it's basically asphyxiation. So I think we have to be sure to keep on promoting the possibility that these children's lives could be spared.
Rashida Tlaib, what are your plans what are your plans when you enter Congress in dealing with Yemen?
Well, first of all, Kathy, thank you so much for your incredible leadership. I think you don't understand, or maybe you truly understand, the importance of movement work outside of the halls of Congress and outside of some of the structures that are there. I think you being out there pushing back against, you know, for me, it's not movement. I mean, when you say there's been some sort of movement in Congress, it's just talk. I think including our own president, talk to me is not movement. We have to have action. We send a lot of money. I think it's in billions of money to the Saudi government. We have so much tremendous of leverage as the United States of America, but we seem to choose to look away when there's other interest at play. And it really is disturbing to me because we need to be the leaders out there and pushing back against these kind of starvations and these kinds of, to me, inhuman cruelty towards children, but even just fellow human beings. This is a generation. These children, we can't get the years back for them. This is really something that's going to reflect on us and our policy for years to come. That Yemeni child is going to grow up and look to us and say, we didn't do anything. We are a leader in the nation. And people say, well, you know, we can't save everyone. But boy, our public dollars are being sent to a lot of these governments that play a leadership role in some of these actions. And we need to use that as leverage to say, no, enough. We're not going to use our public dollars, taxes that my neighbors pay, into a system that does this. It's very disturbing. And I can tell you, even the Yemeni Americans here who have done so much work to raise money to try to send there to help, it's just not enough. And we need people and leadership within the United States Congress to speak up, not to say they're concerned about the murdering of the journalist, not to say that they're, looking into it. No, enough is enough. We know exactly what's happening. Let's stop pretending and let's actually act. By saying to the Saudi government, no money until you stop doing what you're doing to the Yemeni community.
So you're saying cutting off U.S. Military support for Saudi Arabia?
Use it as leverage. It doesn't, to me, even the sanctions that we've done to other countries that have done far less than what the Saudi government has done to the Yemeni people. We have done it before with sanctions and with pulling back our support. And we haven't done an inch of it with the Saudi government. And we absolutely know that they're having a leadership role here in hurting and really the inhumane actions by the government towards the Yemeni community.
And do you believe what President Trump is saying about Saudi involvement with the killing of Khashoggi, Rashida Tlaib? Or what is your response to the Trump administration, Jared Kushner and President Trump, saying they're waiting for the Saudis to investigate themselves and their defense of the crown prince?
Look, that's what they're saying.
Who also ran the war in Yemen.
Yeah. But I know we have our own intelligence, and I know exactly, I'm not there yet, but I'm sure our own intelligence is confirming exactly what the American people already know.
I want to thank you for being with us, Rashida Tlaib. Again, congratulations on being a first. You and Ilhan Omar, the first Muslim American women to enter Congress. I also want to thank Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Please stay with us so we can also talk about what's happening in Afghanistan as you fight for peace around the world. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Jareen, Tay Marie Astudio, and Libby Rainey. To go to our website, you can find our part twos at Web Exclusives. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.